Please turn in your Bibles to Matthew 20. Matthew 20, you can find it on page 825 in your pew Bible. And while you're turning there, just to give you a heads up, next week we will take a break from Matthew just to reflect on the truths that we celebrate at Christmas. And then the next week, which is the first Sunday of the year, I will not be in the pulpit. I will be swapping with Dave Hintz over at Flint Hills Bible Church. And so Dave Hintz will be preaching the first Sunday of the year. The goal is to let y'all hear a good preacher the first Sunday of the year, and then from there, we'll just move on. I'm excited. It's a joy for us to be able to do that and serve one another and be with each other's churches, and I look forward to that. So next Sunday, we'll be out of Matthew. The next Sunday, he'll be here, and then we'll be right back in Matthew. But for this morning, we're in chapter 20, verses 29 to 34. Let me read this for you before we start to walk through. It says in verse 29, "And as they went out of Jericho, a great crowd followed him. And behold, there were two blind men sitting by the roadside. And when they heard that Jesus was passing by, they cried out, 'Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David.' The crowd rebuked them, telling them to be silent. But they cried out all the more, 'Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David.' And stopping, Jesus called them and said, 'What do you want me to do for you?' They said to him, 'Lord, let our eyes be opened.' And Jesus, in pity, touched their eyes, and immediately they recovered their sight and followed him." Over the last several weeks, I'm hoping that you're starting to catch the narrative as it builds to the cross. You're seeing the tension that's beginning to build. Jesus has made his mission clear. He must go to Jerusalem because it's in Jerusalem that he must be betrayed, that he must be handed over by the Jews, the religious leaders, to the Gentiles, specifically the Romans, that he must be crucified on a cross, and as he always included, that he must be raised. But the disciples, as we've learned the last several weeks, still don't get it. They're still not understanding him. So Jesus says, "I'm here to give my life for you," and then James, John, and Mama come up to Jesus, wanting to know how we can best benefit from your kingdom. How do we secure the first and second positions in your kingdom? Obviously, you've got the middle throne. How do my sons get the left and right? This is what they're concerned with. So here Jesus is, miles away from suffering, days away from suffering, and they're promoting themselves, and Jesus calls them out on it. Not just James and John, but the 12. He says, "You guys are looking at leadership and authority and ruling the same way that the pagans do. That is not the way it is in my kingdom. In Christ's kingdom, if you want to be great," Jesus said, "you must be a servant." Jesus said, "If you want to be first in my kingdom, you must be a slave." Both servant and slave, they're lives that are consumed with helping others accomplish their goals. They're consumed with the will of others. They're consumed with putting others before themselves. And Jesus says, "This is what you must do if you want to be great and first in my kingdom." And then after telling them that, he points to himself and says, "In fact, you know what this looks like. Just as I came not to be served, but to serve and to give my life a ransom for many." That is true humility. That is true greatness, Jesus would say. That's how you serve the needs of others around you best, even when it means your own harm. And that's what Christ is about to do in Jerusalem. But that is not the only example of greatness that we get from Jesus. Jesus' whole life was full of other examples that show how great of a servant that he was and is. Jesus was constantly serving people in his life here on earth. He was always teaching and healing and helping. We get so used to these things that we forget what a gift this is, that Jesus would come and do these things. And so my prayer for you this week has been that you wouldn't miss the blessing it is to see Christ serve the way he does in this passage before us. In today's story that we'll read, and by the way, when I say story, I don't mean like story time story. I just mean narrative story. What you'll see is Jesus once again going out of his way to serve people in need around him. And so as you walk through this narrative together, you need to make sure that you're seeing how it shows you Christ's beauty and humility and glory. And you need to do this because every single person in this room is prone to belittle the glory of Christ. You're prone to be held captive to other things and ascribe glory to them rather than Christ. That's believer and unbeliever alike. Every single one of you in this room needs to constantly think of Christ's goodness and greatness and glory, or else you will slip away. The slipping away of Christ, from Christ, is something that happens most of the time imperceptibly. It would be like sitting in a little boat, and you're so busy with what's going on in the boat that you forget to drop anchor, and then little by little you're moving away from where you want to be, and you look up hours later, and you're in a place you never thought you would be, and you wonder how you got there. Well, you got there little by little. Similarly, drifting away from Christ is not usually an overnight activity. It happens every single time you fail to put Christ before your eyes. It happens every single time we read passages just like this, and we read them almost with a yawn on the horizon. So yeah, I've heard that. Jesus healed two blind guys. Okay, let's move on. This is why we drift. And our only hope is to go back to texts like this and pray that God would show us more and more of Christ's glory, because it's Him that we need, and it's a better vision of Him that we need with the eyes of our heart. So by God's grace, that's exactly what we'll get in this passage. In these verses, you'll be able to see another story involving Christ, but if it's understood correctly, by faith, it will compel you to be drawn to Him even more. In this story, you're going to see Christ display Himself as the perfect servant that He just said He was, and that the disciples must serve others. He's about to show them exactly what He means. In the passage, we're going to see that Jesus has the mercy, the time, and the compassion that you need. That's what we're going to learn from this passage. It's truths like this that are going to compel you to not only come to Christ for the first time, but to keep coming back again and again and again, knowing that these things never run out. To come to Christ constantly, because you know He will always have the mercy, time, and compassion you need. So let's begin with that first one there. Let's begin by looking at Jesus and how He has the mercy that you need. Look at verse 29. And as they went out of Jericho, a great crowd followed Him. And behold, there were two blind men sitting by the roadside. Now again, remember the context. Remember, Jesus has just said, I've come to suffer, die, and rise. The 12 are preoccupied with sinful ways of ruling and reigning. Jesus just told them what true greatness is and what servanthood and slavery is demanded in the kingdom. An example being in His life-giving ransom for many. And then we get to this passage. Jesus is on His way to a divine appointment. He's got work to accomplish in Jerusalem, and it's on His way to that immeasurably great work that these two blind men are in need of help. As we enter verse 20, we encounter two supposed contradictions in the Bible that we do need to address. I want to get to the story and unfold it for you, but if you're dealing with this as an unbeliever or with unbelievers, a lot of times you're going to come across issues that they'll bring up in this, even this first verse here. There are two issues in the text that need to be dealt with, both attacking Scripture's inerrancy and infallibility. When we say the Bible has no contradictions, people will point to things just like this to try to trip you up. The two are not equal, and as you'll see. The first supposed contradiction I want to show you is that Matthew says two blind men are in this story. So if you read Matthew, in your head you're picturing whatever you picture, at least two blind men. When you go read Mark and Luke, they say a certain blind man, and then all the passages in Matthew that say we and us say I, me, and my in Mark and Luke. Mark goes so far as to give you his name. His name is Bartimaeus. And so people will point to this and they'll say, here's a contradiction. But again, it's a contradiction that doesn't exist. When Mark and Luke say that there was a certain blind man named Bartimaeus, there was. They choose, for whatever reason, to zero in on one blind man. If they had said there was only one blind man, then your option would be they either are contradicting or they're talking about a different instance altogether. But again, they choose to highlight the words and actions of the one man, Bartimaeus. And again, we're not told exactly why. It could be that in the story, Bartimaeus was the leader of the two blind men. He was the more vocal one, the one pulling the other one, saying, come on. It could have been that. It more likely could be that Bartimaeus was well known in the early church. And so Mark and Luke want to highlight the fact that this is where he interacted with Jesus. But again, we don't know why they zeroed in on one, but the fact that they say there was a certain one named Bartimaeus, and Matthew says there was two, is no contradiction. The harder issue to handle is one that you're likely to read over without even a second thought, and you won't notice it unless you just set them side by side and read them together. For instance, Matthew says that this story happens as they went out of Jericho. You go to Mark, and Mark says this happened as they were going out from Jericho. No problem. But then you look at Luke, and Luke explicitly says this happened as they were approaching Jericho. And so again, you have people who want to attack the Bible. They want to say it's full of contradictions, so they'll say, all right, Christian, which one is it? Did this happen as they were leaving Jericho or as they were approaching Jericho? You can't have it both ways. So again, a lot of times we haven't thought through these things. We might get tripped up. But again, this kind of an approach by them proves a lack of willingness to be fair in the way they think. Everybody is going to give the benefit of the doubt to something. And that's just the way it is. Everybody has their own presuppositions where you're not going to question certain things as easily as other things. As believers who have had our hearts changed, our eyes opened, God has caused us to be born again, just like he promised, with an instinctive nature to love his word. And so when we see something like this, we by nature know, well, God doesn't contradict himself. And so we give the Bible the benefit of the doubt. We know that if we come across something that seems like a contradiction, it only seems like one. We know the Bible has no contradictions because its author never contradicts himself. So we will do our best to figure it out, or we may come to the end and say, look, we just don't have enough information to explain how these two things go together, but we know they don't contradict. That's a believer's default position. But an unbeliever, they need the Bible to have errors, because if the Bible has errors, then that helps them show that the Bible's untrue and it's inaccurate and it's non-authoritative. So this suppressing lifestyle that I'm living is now justified because the book you're trying to explain life to me with shouldn't be trusted. This is the reason they don't give the benefit of the doubt to the Bible. This is why they refuse to think of any possibilities where it could be worked out. But the issue in particular that we're dealing with in Matthew has two common ways of being worked out I want to just make you familiar with. Both could be true, just to be honest. I find one more compelling than the other. The first and most common explanation is the fact that there were two Jerichos. This is true. This is not an easy way out. Sometimes answers are too good to be true. It's like, oh, so the way out of your contradiction is just to say there were two Jerichos? Well, there were. You remember in Joshua 6 in the Old Testament, Joshua fought the battle of what? I guess it's Fit. Joshua Fit the Battle of Jericho, is that how it's said? The idea is it was destroyed there. It was never rebuilt. They didn't do that. Eventually, a great city of Jericho was rebuilt 3 miles, I think, to the south. Of course, everything good goes to the south. But so it could be an instance where they're saying he's leaving Jericho, meaning old Jericho, because there was a road you had to travel through that went through both. So he could be leaving old Jericho and entering new Jericho. So Matthew and Mark are saying he's leaving this one, and Luke is saying he's approaching this one. The point being, it happened on the road in between. That could be one way it's handled. Another way that I find a little bit more compelling is to think about what Luke actually says. Luke says, as he approached Jericho, there were two blind beggars sitting there begging. Mark and Matthew speak of the miracle happening as he's leaving Jericho. So if these beggars were in their normal spot, the city gates, then it makes a whole lot of sense that as Jesus is entering Jericho with the 12 and the crowds, that these blind beggars are there. That's their introduction, if you will. And then it makes sense for, as he's leaving Jericho, for the miracle to happen. That would be kind of the way that I see this unfolding. But either way, Jesus and the 12, the great crowd, they're in Jericho, and these two blind beggars are there, most likely at the city gates, begging. And they're begging because they're beggars. That's all they do. They're blind people. This is what their life was constrained to. There was no life-supporting agency out there to help them in times of trouble. There was no system of Braille where they could go get an education anyway that didn't exist for them at that time. Blind people were overwhelmingly hopeless and helpless and destined to be beggars for their whole life, which is what they're doing. And again, I'll remind you, this would have been a great time, if you ever have to be a beggar, to be at this place at this time as a beggar. The reason is because the crowds are swelling. Thousands and thousands of people are coming through Jericho to get to Jerusalem. You see, I'll remind you again, the Passover is coming up. And so all over Israel, you have people coming to Jerusalem. Well, obviously, you start from all points in Israel. But as you get closer, the roads kind of funnel you all together at some point. And so if you're coming from the northern district, thousands would have been doing that. They would have all traveled through this city of Jericho. Again, not every Jew would have, but those coming from the north certainly would have. So if you're a beggar, I mean, here's thousands of people who are religious enough to make this long trek down to Jerusalem three times a year. Here they are coming through the town, and so this is kind of your Super Bowl of opportunities to beg at the city gates. These crowds, being very religious, would have been your best help all year long. So these crowds come in. The blind beggars can't see anything, obviously, but at some point, somehow, they learn that Jesus is among this crowd, among these travelers. They most likely are learning this because of the buzz in the crowd. I mean, I'm just assuming here, but you hear people say, yeah, that's that guy who healed those people. That's that guy who, yeah, he's over there. He's with us. And as a blind beggar, you hear that, and it catches their ear. Again, for whatever reason, again, we're not told every little detail, but when the two blind beggars hear that Jesus is among the crowd, they receive this as good news. Again, we're not told exactly why they know it's good news, but we know that they think it is enough to start shouting and chasing after him, wondering where he is. Again, I'm imagining, but it could be that they were from some other city. It was common for blind people to come to Jericho. Jericho was known to have the most help for eyesight issues, and so it was common for them to travel. So if they did travel, maybe they used to be in a city where Jesus had done some healings. Maybe they had heard stories about what Jesus had done and how he calmed a storm with just a word and how he caused the lame to walk and the deaf to hear. I'm assuming they've heard stories of how he caused the blind to see, even if it did mean spit and tongues and things like that that they may not particularly enjoy. I don't know what all they knew, but I do know they knew enough that when they heard Jesus was among them, they started shouting. You need to work hard to try your best to get into the position of these blind men shouting for Jesus to help them. Again, I'm not being funny. They can't see anything. They just know somewhere in these thousands of people, there's their greatest hope in life. So they start screaming. They start wandering around. What is it they're yelling? Look at verse 30. And behold, there were two blind men sitting by the roadside, and when they heard Jesus was passing by, they cried out, Lord, have mercy on us, son of David. Again, they're crying this out. They're screaming. This word for cried out here, it's used of demons that shriek. It's even used of women in labor. It's used of passionate screaming. And this is what they would have done, not being able to see a thing. Lord, have mercy on us, son of David, hoping to get above the noise of the crowd so that Jesus would hear them over and over again, screaming and going throughout the town, trying to get his attention. Again, just think for a second, your life of misery as a blind beggar, and you hear that your greatest hope is somewhere in this crowd. You'd be screaming just like they were. And notice what they were screaming. They first of all call him Lord, which, to be fair, in some context can mean sir. But I can't imagine they just mean, hey, good sir, could you have mercy on us? That's not what they're doing here. It most likely refers to the way we understand Lord in the rest of Scripture, that he is God, he is master, ruler. Again, they know enough about this Lord to know that he can give them sight, as you'll learn later in the passage. And it's this one that they're calling Lord that they beg for mercy. So again, when they ask for mercy, I feel the need to always clarify what biblical mercy is, because there's this, I'm not picking on Sunday school in general, but we say there's this Sunday school answer when something's just so rote, you know. There's this Sunday school answer that grace is receiving what you don't deserve, and mercy is withholding what you do deserve. And I understand why that's catchy. It's helpful in the sense that it's pithy, but it's not actually all that biblical. And what I mean by that is it really does an injustice to the idea of mercy in the Bible. What that kind of saying does is it delegates mercy to just the realm of withholding things. And that is not what the Bible presents as mercy. These men are not begging Jesus to just withhold wrath from them. These men are not begging Jesus to withhold punishment and curses from them. These men are asking for Jesus to do something, and they beg for mercy. Mercy is more than the withholding of things. To give you an illustration in the story involving the Good Samaritan, You remember there was a helpless man there, and someone came along and helped him, took care of him, paid for his room, gave extra money, went above and beyond to take care of this person, and the story says that man showed him mercy. Again, so a better way to distinguish mercy and grace, though we don't necessarily need to get too picky with that. A better way is to see grace as emphasizing your unworthiness and the fact that you don't deserve God's help, and then mercy emphasizing your helplessness, that you need God's help. And so these men are recognizing that. Grace highlights your sin. Mercy highlights your terrible situation. And these men, they're blind men. They know I need help. They probably have tried other things to have them see. They need God to actively help them with their eyesight. So they beg for mercy, which is an admission that they are helpless and need God to act. They're begging for mercy, calling Jesus not just Lord, but as you see in the text, Son of David, referencing their conviction that he has the right to rule in the line of David. Because he's Lord, he's being recognized by them as the one who is eternally the right to rule over David's house and David's throne, just like God promised. And I tend to take the word behold that way. So it's a little ironic to say behold in a story with blind men. Don't lose that irony. See? Blind men. So that's a contrast there. But the behold shouldn't be tagged to the fact that there were two blind men begging. That was normal. The behold that Matthew says, behold, two blind men said, Lord, Son of David. I mean, they're seeing who Jesus is, and they're surrounded by thousands of people who don't see who Jesus is. This seems to be the contrast being set up in the story. So you need to hear these blind men begging, screaming for Jesus, and we need to marvel at what they're saying. Again, being blind, they never would have had the education that so many other people would have had. Being blind, they never would have been allowed into certain places. Even in certain cities, they would not have been allowed to enter. And now they hear the chance of a lifetime. Jesus is not just able to help, but he's right there among them. And they weren't going to miss their chance to receive his mercy. They may have missed out on many opportunities in life, but they were not going to miss this one, which in his commentary on this passage, J.C. Ryle said that even among those who are believers, the degree of faith is often strangely disproportionate to the privileges enjoyed. Let me read that again. Even among those who are believers, the degree of faith is often strangely disproportionate to the privileges enjoyed. The point that Ryle's making is that it's an odd and unfortunate correlation that there's an inverse reaction to the opportunities you're given in life and the opportunities you take in life. Ryle's saying that usually those with less opportunities take advantage of more opportunities. So we need to learn from these blind men here to take every opportunity we can, make use of every opportunity that God gives us to benefit from his mercy and grace. When God provides some sort of means or source, some sort of opportunity for us to be with him and know him better, make use of it. Again, just imagine being these two blind men. Imagine how many other times in life they had been disappointed. To have countless people just pass by you and you hear footsteps and you never hear coins going into your little bucket or whatever you're holding. And then to have some little punk come by and throw some rocks in so it sounds like it's help, and then all of a sudden you realize they were just messing with you. Imagine the life that they had lived, and then all of a sudden they hear Jesus is in town, the Son of God, the Son of David, sent to shepherd and help and heal Israel. I mean, you would think at some point in their life they hear about Jesus, because they've heard about him before today somehow, and they think, man, can you imagine if we just got to meet him one time? I mean, can you imagine? I hear he's doing stuff all over Israel and even beyond. I can't imagine what it would be like to actually get to be with him and to ask him to help us. And then all of a sudden this happens. He enters your town where you are. He's there. He's in the same crowd that you're begging from. They would never let this opportunity pass by. They were going to take full advantage of it. They know what kind of gift it is to be this close to Jesus and in such great need. They are convinced that Jesus alone has the mercy that they need, and they know that Jesus alone can help them with the problems in life, especially the ones that are associated with their lack of sight. And so they're screaming and they're searching, and their main motivation, as you read in the passage, is give us mercy. They know they not only need mercy, but they know Jesus has mercy to give. So they're after him. And again, it's an encouraging lesson for you and me to think about how many opportunities have passed you by because you either didn't see yourself in that great of a need or you just assumed, I'll just take the next opportunity. You can think of how many times you've been in a church service or in a Bible study or in a helpful meeting with another Christian or whatever situation. You've had this opportunity to behold Christ. You've had this opportunity to be blessed by Christ. You just let it by. Either because I just don't think I need to put that kind of effort into this kind of a thing, or you know what, I'll just get serious about it next time. So you fail to give your own soul the time and attention it needs. Again, it's not because you don't give things time and attention. It's because you don't give your soul time and attention. Think of the things that do get your effort in life. Think of the things that get your life's energy. Think of all that you're earnest about in life, and then ask yourself, does my soul get this kind of attention? Am I earnest about things that actually will matter and do matter? Again, if you're honest, you'll see that time after time, service after service, study after study, book after book, conversation after conversation, you have not taken full advantage of what Christ has presented you with in life. These men are not going to make that mistake. They know what they need, and better yet, they know who it is they need. They need the one that is not just among them, but is among them with the mercy that they need. Again, this should cause you to keep a fresh perspective on your own needs, living with a clear view of your helplessness without Christ, your need for God's mercy constantly, knowing that you are so helpless in so many ways that you jump at the opportunity to benefit from Christ. And so you do it because, number one, you're convinced that Jesus has the mercy you need. So you go to him. But secondly, in the passage, we're going to see that Jesus has the time you need. These men are on a mission. They are going to find Jesus. They know they are in need of mercy, as I said. They know the one that can give it to them is right there. They don't know exactly where he is, but he's somewhere around there. There is nothing that will stop them from getting to Jesus. But that doesn't mean they won't face obstacles. Look at verse 31. The crowd rebuked them. It's the two blind guys, telling them to be silent. But they cried out all the more, Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David. Again, these poor blind beggars are screaming for Jesus. Try to imagine the scene. You're in a crowd of thousands. There would have been a lot of blind beggars. And two of them keep screaming after the most important person among you. Again, we're not given an exact reason for the rebuke here. But we know that it had something to do with these people should not be bothering Jesus. Jesus' time should not be spent on people like this. It could have been just a natural cultural disdain for blind beggars. Look, it's not right for people like you to cause such a scene. People like you should be seen, not heard, and honestly, we'd rather just not see you either. So be quiet. It could have been that, or it could have been that the crowd was unable to hear Jesus talk when they were yelling. It's like, well, you two keep it down. We want to hear what he's saying. We want to hear what he's telling his disciples. We want to hear what he's teaching. Quite possibly, it could have been that the crowds knew Jesus was going to Jerusalem. They may have known he's going there, and they've watched him for 3 years. They know the showdown's coming. And so kind of like setting up for the next UFC pay-per-view or something. And they're just going, look, don't stop this man. We want to see this. We don't like the scribes. We don't like the Sadducees either. We want to see him go to Jerusalem and take care of him. Again, no matter the specific reason that they rebuked the blind man, they did rebuke him, but it was to no avail. It was vainly done. All it did was cause them to cry out even more. They created more of a scene. Again, a testimony to their faith being made visible. They would not be stopped. They knew they needed Jesus, and they had to get to him. So again, think of all that was going against these men. Two blind men, two blind beggars, Mark tells us. They're in the wrong city. Look, boys, I'm sorry. He's not staying here. He's just traveling through to get to the really important place. So here they are, the wrong people in the wrong city at the wrong time. There is no way somebody as important as Jesus, on a mission like Jesus, will give them the time of day. There's no way he's going to slow down his agenda. There's no way he's going to change his itinerary. There's no way that these two incredibly insignificant people on a national level are going to get the attention of the king of the Jews. He has real business to attend to. But that's the kind of thinking that is wrongheaded. It goes against what Jesus just taught in verse 26. Look back at verse 26. He says, whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be your slave, even as the Son of Man, that's Jesus, came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. Jesus says that, and then we see this story play out. What do you think he's going to do? He's certainly not going to act like he's too good for these men. Verse 32, notice what he does. And stopping, Jesus called them and said, what do you want me to do for you? As always, try to put yourself in the scene. Imagine Jesus walking through Jericho, walking out of Jericho, towards his announced appointment with the betrayer and the Jews and the Gentiles and the cross. Imagine how much that must have been weighing on him. And at the same time, thousands around him that misunderstand him, they have various motivations of why they're there, why they're asking him for things. He would have had so much commotion inside and outside of him. And still, in the midst of all that, Jesus stops. The two blind beggars have been yelling for his attention, and finally they get it. Now again, I'm not trying to be funny, but when Jesus stops, that's a physical action that they can't see. They don't see that. They don't even know where he is. And so it says that Jesus stopped. And the crowds would have seen it first, probably wondering, hey, what important things is he going to say? You know, what great work is he about to do for somebody really important? Again, Jesus stops and he calls the two blind men, which Mark helps fill out for us. It says that when Jesus called the two men, what he did was he sent somebody to the blind men to tell them to come here. And actually the message, when he gets to the blind man, it says, take heart, get up, he's calling you. I can imagine screaming for however long they were screaming, trying to get to Jesus, and finally someone says, hey, he wants to see you. Again, you wonder what kind of cruelties these two blind beggars would have faced before. In my mind, again, this is just me thinking, it would have been tempting to say, look, you got to stop messing with me. I'm not playing here. Just leave me alone. Don't set me up for another cruel joke. But that is not what happened. Jesus sent for them, and they came. They came immediately. Mark says, leaving the cloak, they took off. And when they came to Jesus, he asked them in verse 32, what do you want me to do for you? Again, it seems like a silly question. It's like, oh, I don't know, Einstein. What do these two blind men want you to do for them? I think it's to recover their sight. Again, it is obvious, but you need to learn that God, just generically referencing God or specifically Jesus in his ministry, he doesn't always ask questions to require new information. Sometimes he's asking questions to reveal the heart of someone, to have the words actually spoken. So he asked them, what do you want me to do for you? And again, what you need to see here is that Jesus has time for these men, these two blind men. Two men, I'm assuming, he's never seen before or met before. Two men that have real needs that are impossible for any of us to help with. Two men that have nothing to offer him. Two men that are not on his agenda. Two men that are going to slow down his process to his ultimate goal of going to Jerusalem, and two men that probably would have given him a bad reputation, because if you want to be king of Israel, you probably don't want to associate too much with the blind beggars in the street. But this king does. He not only has time for the two blind beggars, but he makes the time for them, never showing one single ounce of sinful interruption or frustration with them. Jesus had so much, again, going on around him and in him, and for him to stop here reveals so much about his patience and care and concern for others. I mean, just imagine if these two men were convinced that Jesus could help them, but then had believed the lie that he just doesn't have time for us. I mean, we're two blind beggars. He's the king of Israel. What in the world is he going to do with us? They would have failed to come to Christ because they would have assumed the wrong thing. You know, they would have missed out on the meeting of a lifetime and literally received sight. They would have missed all that. And so, again, we need to learn from this, not only that Jesus has the mercy that we need, but also has the time we need. It is a lie from the pit that tells you Jesus can't help you, but it's also one that says that he doesn't have time to help you. Again, when pastors and Christians encourage lost and saved, everyone alike, to come to Christ, that's not something we made up. It's not like us hearing he does great things and saying, hey, you should go to him. It's him announcing he does great things, displaying he does great things, and saying, come to me. He's the one that said earlier in Matthew, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." It was his idea for people in need to bombard him. Again, he's the one that told the needy to come. It's a lack of faith that causes you to hesitate. Jesus said, come. Not come during the hours of 9 to 5, or not come every day except weekends, or not. He doesn't qualify it. He doesn't say, come to me only if your problems are pretty easy and won't take too long. He says, come. Again, we are the ones that make all kinds of things up that cause us to hesitate to come to Christ. Jesus just says, come. So these two blind men come. And again, they know that Jesus has the mercy they need, and they know that he has the time they need, and it's seen in the fact that he stopped for them. Again, tons of blind people around, tons of people around in the crowds, and Jesus stops for these two extremely insignificant people on the large scale of things. Again, it should help you see that Jesus has the mercy and time that you need. But thirdly, notice Jesus also has the compassion you need. Again, this is where the passage turns from knowing what Jesus can do for me to watching what Jesus actually does for people. And you got to remember, Jesus asked them, what is it you want me to do for you? And so in verse 33, look at it. It says, Lord, let our eyes be opened. Again, I know we've grown used to things like this, but these blind men just asked another human, we know he's more than that, but they just looked at another man and said, can you help my blind eyes see? Again, imagine if somebody made that request to me. I'm on a phone call on Tuesday, and they say, hey, well, I've got you on the phone. When will be a good time to come in this week? I know it's Christmas, but are you and Aaron going to be in the office? Because I got a blind nephew coming to town. I really need you guys to give him some eyesight. It's like, listen, bud, like, I can pray for you. I can put you in touch with the one that can help you, but that is above my pay grade. That's not in my ability. Imagine how insane it would be to ask any other human to help you with this. Again, this shows that they know Jesus is more than a good man. He's more than a helpful man. He's more than another prophet. To them, Jesus is Lord, Son of David, the one that can give mercy, the one that will take time to give mercy, and the one that can have compassion and actually help them. Again, notice the faith that these blind men have. They knew, as was commonly known in Israel at that time, Isaiah 35 promised when the Messiah comes, this is what it says in Isaiah 35, then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame men leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. So they asked Jesus to do this. You are the Messiah. You are the Son of David. Give us eyesight. Verse 34, look what happens. And Jesus in pity touched their eyes, and immediately they recovered their sight and followed him. Again, the text says in the ESV, in pity he did this. Some of your versions will say, or moved with compassion he did this. And it gets us back to one of my favorite word pictures about the intestines. What I mean is, in our day, if you want to talk about the way someone feels, you reference their what? Their heart. I love you with all my what? Heart. And if you want to talk about the way people think, you reference their brain. Put your brain into it, that kind of thing. That is not the way the Bible talks. The Bible does not talk about people necessarily thinking with their brain. Now, it does talk about people thinking. Don't think you're off the hook. But it talks about the center of your thinking is in your heart. For instance, we have passages like this. You'll know it. Fill in the blank for me. Trust in the Lord with all your what? Heart. And do not, so the opposite of trusting in the Lord with all your heart, do not lean on your own what? Understanding. So it links heart and understanding together. That's because in Scripture, the parallel with heart and thinking and mind and understanding and knowing is throughout the whole Scripture. But if that's the case, if we think with our heart, then where is it that we feel? And that's where Scripture comes in with these great word pictures. It's in the bowels. That's where you feel. So for instance, again, we have this kind of language. When someone drops a bomb on you with some devastating news, you're likely to say, man, it felt like a punch in the what? Gut. Or maybe you know of something going on that really bothers you, and you say, man, every time I think of that, it just makes me sick to my what? Stomach. So again, we have this kind of language. We don't talk about bowels very much, but stomach, gut language. You get butterflies. We know that feeling. That's the language going on here. In pity or in compassion, it's the word dealing with the bowels. Jesus is feeling this in his gut. Again, Jesus is not robotically helping these men. He's not some cold, lifeless doctor. Jesus is actually feeling a burden for these men. Not only is it amazing to read because Jesus is God, and why on earth should God care about such lowly creatures like this, but it's also amazing to read because he's the God in flesh man who came on a mission, and you're going to take time on the way to the cross to deal with these two blind men? Again, this is amazing to read, and still, Jesus amazes us with the way that he takes time, not just for men, but these kind of men. Again, it's quite a scene to behold. In pity, in his bowels, with compassion, Jesus, first of all, touches their eyes, which would have been such welcomed human interaction. I mean, when was the last time you touched a beggar? Just think about that. We don't do that. And Jesus touches their face. Again, incredibly intimate here. But he's not done. He touches their eyeballs. He touches their face. And immediately their sight is recovered. Which, again, we read that. And it's like, well, yeah, I know that. It's like, do you remember the fact that these men had not seen before this part? And now they see? I mean, think of how amazing it is. I've heard stories of people who are colorblind their whole life. Sitting at a red light, all of a sudden they see color. I mean, that's amazing. But it still is kind of like you saw this way and now you see this way. Like, okay, that's amazing. But it's not. You couldn't see at all and now you see. This is amazing. And the only difference between them seeing and not seeing is Jesus. Once again, showing how amazing Jesus is. He's not some of these TBN personalities that only get people who have, you know, migraines and internal backaches. And those are the people on the stage. You don't see people who need limbs grown on stage. You don't see people whose ears have fallen off. Can you put this on for me? You don't see that because it's all smoke and mirrors. Jesus deals with real problems and he really heals people. Again, Jesus is the real deal, actually sent to actually help people, give them sight in this passage. But the reality, as we've been reading, is their physical eyeballs now seeing Jesus in front of them. I mean, imagine that. The first thing, your eyes open up, and the first thing you see is the one that just gave you sight. But as we've read the passage, we know all their physical eyeballs did was just catch up to the eyes of their heart. We learned very early on, these men know exactly who Jesus is. They know Jesus' true identity, and it was before their eyes were open. So it's no surprise in verse 34 to watch them respond this way. And Jesus, in pity, touched their eyes, and immediately they recovered their sight, notice, and followed him. Which could generically just mean they just took up the trip to Jerusalem with him. I think it does mean that, but it means a lot more. The reason we say that is because Luke explicitly says they responded by glorifying God. The crowds that saw it glorified God. So when they followed Jesus here, it wasn't just, I'm interested to go to Jerusalem with you. It's now they're a disciple. They previously knew in their heart that Christ was who he was, and now they see him, and now they follow him with their life, just like Christ calls people to do. Jesus helps these men see, and as we noticed in this verse, it comes from a real compassion. See, it's not enough for you to be convinced that Jesus has the mercy you need. It's not enough to be convinced that Jesus has the time you need. You also have to constantly convince yourself that Jesus has the compassion you need. This is what's going to drive you over and over again to come to Christ. Being convinced that Christ really does care about whatever it is you're bringing to him. Again, you have to keep all three of these, this mercy, time, and compassion, in perspective. The reason is your flesh, the world, and the devil love every single day, every single week, every single month. They love to twist these things and cause you to doubt it. So again, just imagine for a second if you really believe Jesus had the time and compassion, but not the mercy. Imagine if Jesus really cared greatly and would take all the time in the world for you, but just couldn't do anything about it. That would not compel you to come. Imagine if Jesus had the mercy and compassion, so he's able to help you. He really cares about you, but he just doesn't have the time. Like, look, you don't understand what this whole upholding the universe business is about. Could you just leave me alone with your, like, personal family squabbles? And I don't need to hear about that. Lastly, think if Jesus had the mercy and compassion, so he's able to help you. Time and compassion. He greatly cares for you. He has all the time in the world, not able to help. Jesus has mercy and compassion, but no availability. But lastly, think about Jesus having mercy and time, but no compassion. Just some cold, lifeless guy saying, yeah, I see all the problems, but who cares? we get help in this when all three of these items, time, compassion, and mercy, come together in Hebrews 4. Listen to what it says. We do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then come with confidence, draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Hebrews 4 highlights all three things we're seeing in this passage. Jesus is amazing not just because he has the mercy or the time or the compassion that you need. He's amazing because he always has all three of those things. He really is available, able, and willing, caring, and ready, standing ready to help those who come to him. The lies that the world and your flesh will tell you contradict that. They'll make you think you're just a burden. Haven't you asked forgiveness for this like 372 times? This is not the picture we get from Christ. It's one we throw on him. Jesus is the perfect Savior and the perfect servant that you need, willingly serving those who come to him, no matter the convenience that they actually may be, no matter the inconvenience they appear to be, no matter what's going on. And he does it because he really does care. So like Hebrews says, know these things are true and be compelled to come to Christ. I know he's able to be sympathetic. I know he's going to make the time to help me in my needs. And I know he's able to help me, so I will come. Again, if you've never come to Christ before, Christ at this very moment stands ready to receive everyone who comes to him. But even to those of you who have come to Christ, those of you who are saved, passages like this ought to remind you of why you need to keep coming to Christ. Again, never thinking that you're some undesired burden on him. Come to Christ again and again and again. Use stories like this to help remind yourself that your neediness is not some constant thorn in his side. Again, sometimes it's easy for you to feel like you've exhausted his grace, but we remember Christ is infinite, so his grace is infinite. Sometimes it's easy for you to think that you've caused him to grow impatient, but that's impossible. He has infinite patience. The whole thing of coming to Christ with your problems was his idea. Let him take care of it. Again, we come to Christ now. We come to Christ every single moment of our need. And we come knowing that he has the mercy, the time, and the compassion that we need every single time we come to him. So let's go to him now and pray for grace in these matters.